Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Robert Bob Swan. Many of you know him as the guiding force of opera at the Acorn Theater, but he has a phenomenal background in the arts that we're going to be talking about today on With Respect. Again, Bob Swan, With Respect. Bob, how are you this morning?
Well, I'm feeling wide awake, perky.
Well, all right. Opera, Bob Swan. I saw the Three Tenors performance that recently at the Acorn Theater, and was very impressed. But now I know that you're behind it. I know that you're behind opera here in Three Oaks. But where did you come from? Tell me about it.
Oh, boy. Where did I come from?
I know God brought you, or
yeah,
the stork, and then, one
yeah,
of the two.
The first thing that I was ever paid to do was sing. I was 7 years old, and I made 5 cents a week at my church, and I was always the best singer.
And where was that?
That was in Hyde Park. It was St. Paul's Episcopal Church at 50th and Dorchester.
I'll bet you were not a bass at that time.
No, but I actually kept singing. I actually kept singing soprano even after my voice changed, which I think is the reason I have a long range. I was mm-hmm. able to kind of flip back and forth. My voice changed, I think, like when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, I was making $5 a week.
Whoa.
Yeah.
At the same church?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
All right.
I was really fortunate. The guy who was our choir master was a guy named Bob Rayfield, who had been a singer himself. He didn't have a big enough voice to support himself. He couldn't sing. He could never sing at the Met, but he had a very nice light tenor voice, and he was a great guy. He was a fighter pilot in the Korean War, and he was a great, great musician. He introduced me to Bach and to Mozart and that kind of thing, and gave me my first voice lessons, really, although I didn't know that's what it was at the time. And so I started out kind of singing, you know, really, when I think about it, about as far back as I can remember. I'm not like one of these guys who remembers stuff when he was two.
The birth canal or something.
No,
yeah.
No.
Well, now, what about your parents? Were they also singers, musicians? What were they?
Well, my dad taught biology and then physics at the laboratory schools. I got a free ride at the U of C lab school. And my mom was a psychologist in the public school system in Chicago.
Which school?
On the south side, mm-hmm. kind of all over the place. She was
rotated.
Rotated a lot, yeah.
Yeah, because my mother was also a teacher in the Chicago public school system, and my aunts were. It was they used to call themselves the Iron Maidens of the Chicago public school system. But each of them put in 30 years.
I think you had to be made of iron.
Oh,
to do
you had
that.
To be tough. You had to be tough on those days. In fact, one of my aunts, one of her classes, 1 year she had Jeff Fort, who was the head of the
right, I know.
The
like
L. Rukins. That's right.
Yeah.
And he was, I guess, repeating fourth grade for the fifth time or something like that.
I know a gal who married him and had his baby.
Holy cats.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Her name was Margot Gray.
I'll be darned.
And she, then he went to prison.
Yep.
Later
he did.
On. And she stayed in the community, had his baby and whatever, and then he got some kind of, I remember, he got some kind of word that she had cheated on him after mm-hmm. 10 years in jail or something, I forget what it was, and was out to kill her. Mm-hmm. And the last I saw of her, she was hiding out in another friend of mine's place. And this is a gal who was the most bright, beautiful, talented person I think I've ever known. She was a great dancer and a singer, played every instrument, spoke like five languages. She was just an elegant person, but she believed in their cause. And mm-hmm. so she you know, was raised in a completely, she was raised on the East Coast and then, mm-hmm. you know, was doing, I don't know. But the last I saw of her, she was hiding in a girlfriend's house, a gal who used to be a belly dancer. So it's a pretty good story.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Well, you know, funny, I was, when I was U.S. attorney, the USAG sent me over to Chicago to be, I was not only U.S. attorney in Western Michigan, but I also did special U.S. attorney role in Chicago to prosecute the El Rukins.
Really?
And by that, right. We weren't prosecuting Jeff Ford. He was already in prison, but we were prosecuting the 67 top leaders of that organization, the El Rukins street gang. And not nice people. Very not nice.
Yeah.
But so we used to hear about Jeff and his fooling around.
Yeah. Boy, that's really going back a ways.
It is, yeah.
Really, for me, yeah. Boy.
Well, now, so your dad was a teacher.
Yes, I took a class from my dad.
Oh, there's
I took a physics class.
Conflict of interest.
Well, I'm telling you, first of all, that's the hardest I've worked on any class in my life. Because I was at the lab school, it's full of really bright people. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and I couldn't be on the bottom of the class. I was second in my class in his class. The only guy who beat me out was a guy named David Friedman, the son of Milton Friedman, who happened to be kind of a genius, you know.
Yeah,
it's the only guy who beat me out.
That's good.
Yeah, you know, my dad never said anything to me at all about what I had to do or anything. And there was nothing implied, but there was nothing I could do but work really, really, really hard at that and make sure I was good at it,
yeah.
You know. Otherwise, I would be, because the kids did look to me. They would come to me for answers and stuff because they knew that I was on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, you know. But he never made any requests. He never, you know, put the heavy hand on me or anything like that.
Self-discipline. I used to say that there are three things which should motivate people to behave decently. The first is external discipline. That is fear of punishment by the state. I'm going to go to prison. The second one is, and by the way, that first one is very expensive, considering
yeah.
prison and the
yeah.
court system and
right.
the law enforcement system.
Yeah.
The second one, which is not as expensive and much more informal, and that is you behave yourself because if you didn't, you would be humiliated in a community which meant something to you,
yeah.
such as a neighborhood or a family
right.
or
yeah.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that can keep people in line as well. But the best and the cheapest way of getting good behavior is instilling in young people and carrying right on through the rest of their lives a sense of self-discipline. And you behave yourself because you want to. You see the advantage. You feel the conscience advantage of good behavior. So, self-motivation is pretty strong.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was that was a kind of a blend of fear of humiliation and the other for me. You know, because I did not want to be humiliated at home with my dad. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was also, and this is something that I wonder how things are doing these days. I've got a couple of friends who teach and stuff, and they have a lot of kids who are not curious.
Mm-hmm.
I was
mm-hmm.
curious.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to know. I really liked to learn stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the kids in my school were like that. You know, they really wanted to know stuff.
And frankly, that you feed off one another.
Yeah, yeah.
And just as it is hard to excel in a group which is not interested in excelling because there's no peer motivation,
yeah.
Vice versa, where there is a lot of peer motivation, that's another reason why you want to achieve or want to learn.
Yeah, well,
my
nephews went to other schools. My brother couldn't afford to send them to the lab school, and they were amongst the brightest in their class, and they had these gangs and people, whatever, and they would make fun of them for doing so well,
mm-hmm.
and they would try to humiliate them for being so good
mm-hmm.
at what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they would also make them give them answers to stuff and do all kinds of sort of intimidation or whatever. These guys were not interested in anything except just getting through school. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about my nephews. I'm talking about many, many of the people
around
in their classes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I don't get that. I can't even imagine going to a school like that where, it's no longer a good thing to be good at something.
Mm-hmm.
That just boggles my mind.
Well, you know, if you sat down and analyzed every different kind of grouping of people, I would imagine that you would find that in almost every group, there is, whether it's classes in school or municipalities or corporations or unions or churches or whatever, you will find some sort of people wanting to stand out. Now, it may be in how they dress. It may be in being a bully. It may be in being popular with the girls or boys and so on. But there's always something. But this intellectual curiosity took you somewhere. We know that you quadrupled your income, or you increased it by 500,000%, because you went from, was it 50 cents a week to $5 a week?
5 cents a week.
$0.05.
That's
even more.
That's right. Yeah.
So where did you go?
I consulted with Milton Friedman and made an economic plan.
And said, wait a minute, I can do better than 50 cents or 5 cents. What other interests did you have besides music?
Well, I was going to school, so I liked most of my classes. I liked the languages. I liked math. I liked math a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got out of school. I was interested in biology and all that, so I wanted to become a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of an apprentice to a surgeon at the University of Chicago Hospitals, where I worked with him. I worked in his lab, did research with him, and occasionally actually scrubbed into operations and stuff. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a surgeon as well. And at a certain point, I'll sort of compress things a little bit. At a certain point, I decided that I didn't want to be in a hospital all my life, and
mm-hmm.
and that all you know, I'd been in school all my life, and I was going to be in a hospital where it all smelled the same, all looked the same,
mm-hmm.
all sounded the same. Everybody calling Mr. Blue, all that stuff would be this. Doesn't matter where in the world I was,
mm-hmm.
that's what I was going to see, because the fellow that I was emulating was there 16 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had no feelings. Family life was a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to go into it, but I mean, he basically ignored his family for his career.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't see doing that. So mm-hmm. I kind of dropped out for about a year and smoked pot,
mm-hmm.
For about a year, and started singing for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, well, I got to do something, so I'll go sing for a living.
So where did you start singing?
I started I did a lot of church jobs. You can do a lot of different church jobs on weekends. You know, there's mm-hmm. Chicago Sunday Evening Club, and that's Sunday
mm-hmm.
evening.
That's right.
There is. You can often do a couple other church jobs on Sunday, and then the synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
I joke with my Jewish friends that I'm probably more Jewish than they are, because I know all the songs, and I've been there. I've been going more regularly than they did in later life, I can still remember them all.
Were there any other interests that you had aside from singing? Now, singing gives you a wide range of things to do. I mean, from rap, which I'm not sure I consider singing, to high opera or Gregorian chant or folk music, blues, bluegrass. So that's a wide range of things. But what dragged you or brought you or pulled you or pushed you into opera, for example?
Well, I wonder, because, the first opera I ever saw was Nabucco, and I was bored to tears.
Mm-hmm.
It was a park and bark opera, as we call them.
Mm-hmm.
And, people just come out and stand on stage and, I didn't know how to listen to it. And then later on, I think it was Madame Butterfly, and that's, of course, self-explanatory and very accessible
mm-hmm.
Music and performance. It wasn't that I ever that I dreamt about being an opera singer or an actor or anything like that. I was strictly, doing a seat of the pants kind of thing. I stopped my education, and I did start to go to music schools and stuff like that. But I stopped my education in that too, about 2 credits short of getting a degree, because I didn't want a degree. I didn't want to be able to teach because I knew I was a crummy teacher. My dad was a great teacher, and I really respect the profession, And I hated my terrible teachers and loved my great teachers, you know. I really, really loved the profession, and so I thought, well, I'm not going to go in and be a bad teacher. That's not going to happen. I'm either going to make my living doing this stuff, or I'm going to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped basically studying the stuff, and I went out and tried to make a living singing. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break now. We've been talking to Bob Swan, opera impresario of the Acorn Theater, and soon to take his work international, I'm suppose. I'm making it up. All right. We'll be right back. We're now back with Bob Swan, opera impresario, opera singer, actor from our area, lives in Rolling Meadows and Rolling Prairie.
Rolling Prairie, please.
Yeah. In Indiana, but is very much attached to Harbor Country in Michigan as well. Bob, when we broke, you were talking about taking things from the theoretical to the practical. There was an old phrase that we had in the seminary, learned just as you learn to do by doing and you learn to love by loving, you learn to sing by singing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it whether it came naturally or not, it sounds like it came pretty naturally, but it still takes a lot of work. So how did you develop your skills from the point you, for the time and your talent from the time that you made the decision not to go to academia, but to actually go out and to make a living singing? How did that happen?
Huh. It's kind of one of the larger lessons of my life that I've learned that, sometimes, I would never have been able to conceive of being a singer or an actor. In my family, it was academia. That's what they were schooling and the thing, and my parents were... I would say, deeply disappointed that I didn't continue my education and become a doctor. I mean, they were worried about me and, I never conceived that you could make a living at it. It never entered my Weltanschauung, if you will. Just haven't used that word in a while.
That's been a while. I've used that word, but I haven't heard anybody else use it in English sentence today.
You're not going to hear it for another 10 or 20 years either, probably.
Your worldview is a German word for worldview.
That's right, yeah. Sometimes it's hard to know what you love. It's hard. I think it's hard to know sometimes, or hard to have the courage to understand how you feel. I think you really have to somehow or other give yourself permission to do stuff. And sometimes it comes from out of the blue. Sometimes it comes from circumstances that you're in. And for me, it was circumstances, I think, kind of just forced me into what I love to do, mm-hmm. I guess. You know, what happened as far as acting is concerned is that my voice teacher tried to turn me into a Heldentenor. It's another German word.
Okay. And what is a Heldentenor?
It's a heroic tenor, so-called. It's a Fach, as they call it in German, a brand of voice that is used for heroic Wagnerian singing for the mm-hmm. most part. It's many Heldentenors are baritones who are just singing a little bit higher, who've got an extended high voice. And I had a high B natural, which is in Pavarotti territory, mm-hmm. and it was pretty spectacular. But there was no making a living in Chicago as a Heldentenor, mm-hmm. you know, with all the things that I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see a musical. I went to see Fiddler on the Roof at Candlelight Dinner Playhouse mm-hmm. back in the day. Lee Pelty, you know, as Tevye. And I took a look at that show and I said, well, I can do that. I'll just do that. And so the next thing I did was I auditioned for Stratford, Ontario. And then I auditioned for Summer Stock at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, Illinois. And they offered me a contract first, and then I got offered a contract from Stratford. Mm-hmm. But I'd already signed the contract for Sullivan, so.
Isn't that fascinating how life happens, takes you in different directions?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to go here. They don't answer quickly enough.
Yeah.
Now you're stuck.
Yeah, I mean, I.
That blends you, it develops you. It puts a little harder edge on you, on your talents, doesn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm really a very lucky person because I actually have some talent. Mm-hmm. I mean, who knew? I didn't know. I didn't know whether I was talented. I got hired. Mm-hmm. People hired me. I don't know what, I might be a criminal by now for all I know if I hadn't been able to do that or a taxi driver or something like that, because that's what I was doing. I was driving a cab when I got my contract and went down to Sullivan, Illinois. I drove a cab for about 3 months, and I'm telling you, man, that was that's the hardest work I've ever done.
Just driving a cab.
Oh yeah, hardest, most dangerous job I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Well, except for construction, but I didn't do construction very long. It didn't last long.
All right, before Sullivan, you drove a cab. You were in what kind of construction were you in?
I remember I helped dig out this. I think it's a bank building on Oak Street, and I don't know if it's Wells or whatever, but it's right close. It's, you mm-hmm. know, I drive by that. I go, man, that was rough because it was like 110 degrees. And then we're down in this pit. And my brother, who's an architect, had gotten me this job with a construction company. And he knew this guy, and so he got me this job. But they didn't want me there. They wanted one of their buddies to be there. So they put me down in the pit with, I mean, talking about mosquitoes humidity and 110 degrees, and you're in this mud, and they had me shoveling mud and whatever all day long. And I remember I lasted like 3 days at that. I was the evening when I came home, and I got into the tub and I couldn't get out. I had to have my dad come. So it goes back, you know, quite a ways.
Yeah.
I'd have my dad come help me get out of the tub because I was just, and I was in good shape too.
Yeah.
Just killed me. But then I got a job driving a cab for about 3 months. Got into a crash, crashed into by a felon who was being chased by the cops, that was going to be my last fare too. It was right before I was, you know, that's a whole other story. But anyway, you know, I didn't have enough. Jobs to make a living as a singer, mm-hmm. as strict operas. Well, I wouldn't even do an opera. Although I did do a couple of gigs at the Lyric, a couple of small compromarios, they call it, and I worked in the Chicago Symphony Chorus, and I also got special jobs there too. I always got singled out. People were always choosing me because mm-hmm. I guess I was good,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But it's not something you didn't walk in, wake up one day and said, man, am I good.
No, I've never really felt actually all that much a part I never devoted myself to acting the way that you hear about people going to these classes and getting in touch with their inner selves and all this kind of stuff. And my theory about acting is that, you see children do it in the movies all the time. They're not doing the method or anything else. They're pretending. Now you got to be sad. Now you got to do this. And my theory is that anybody who can convince their mom that they're sick enough to not go to school, is a good actor. And I could do that.
Now, music came first after cab driving.
Let's see. Boy, I'm getting confused here. Music came first before cab driving, because I was trying to be a Helton tenor, and then of course I had no jobs.
Right.
And then I did do musicals, but I also often what happened to me is I would get hired because I could sing, and then they would give me a job that didn't involve singing. I would just act, and then I would get it. I would go into the first time I went to Broadway, or the only time I went to Broadway, was as a singer in a play that otherwise was just all talk. But I was the town drunk who was singing. I sang two songs.
Yeah,
they were really nice songs, and a lot of it was really really
what
cool.
What was the play?
Freedom of the City by Brian Friel. Did at the Goodman. And then it got taken to Broadway, and they took three people, and then they left me out. And then the fellow who was doing my part couldn't do it, because it turned out you had to be a real singer to do it.
Oh no, not that!
Yeah, yeah.
No dubbing.
No. One of the things that he had to do was lead the audience in this song, and so you had to be able to listen to the accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
And sing and lead the audience in the song, and that requires a musician. And the guy that they hired was a good actor, but he couldn't do it. And I had put in the mind of the director that I was quite willing to, be available to help him out, because I knew how hard it was to do. That it was really hard to do, to not get out of sync with the thing and make it seem like it was natural and spontaneous, So... I've always been able to do that. I've always been able to sing along. But I can sing, along with music minus one stuff, and make it sound natural.
No, but singing, acting, I've heard both seem to be interchangeable during your life there, during this part of your career.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I don't know. Well, it from doing musicals, I started auditioning for straight plays, so-called, And I got hired a lot doing that. The first 5 years of my acting career was mostly spent doing straight plays, and I dovetailed them. I would be rehearsing one while I was performing in another, and go back and forth for 5 years. And then one day, all of a sudden, I was out of work. The first time since I'd become an actor. I mean, because otherwise, I worked solidly. And I discovered I didn't have any money, and unemployment wasn't happening. They're much better at that these days, but I didn't get my unemployment. And so we were living on $15 a week for food. That's us and about five dogs. So one day I walked down to the welfare office because I couldn't afford bus fare. And I stood outside. I took a look in, and I thought, you know what? If I have to do this, I'm doing something else. This is not going to happen. And that day, I ran into a guy downtown who did voiceovers. And
this is in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah. It was downtown Chicago. He was the voice of a lot of critters for Leo Burnett. And he made $250,000 a year, somebody told me. And I listened to his voice. I said, well, I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do. And so I spent about a half a year. I stole people's demo tapes and did all kinds of stuff. And I practiced really hard, really worked hard at it. I worked you know, 12 hours a day, like any regular people. Mm-hmm. It's no harder than most people work, but I worked really hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I became genuinely good at it. I became eventually one of the top, for a while, I would say I was one of the top 20 in the country, something like that. You know, I was good.
What did you do in, that our audience might recognize as far as voiceovers?
Oh, I did. I've done a lot of beers. I did a lot of Schlitz. I did some Marlboro. I did Nine Lives Dry. Nine Lives presents. You know, like that. You know, there's all kinds of stuff like that. And what is the candy I did recently? But I did Coors.
Beer?
Yeah, Coors beer. I did a lot of beer. I've done, you know, fights and stuff. All kinds of. It's kind of hard for me to remember now. It's been a long time.
But you have, this also wove around your music at odds and ends kinds of
things.
Well,
I didn't. Once I started doing voiceover, I kind of pulled back out of music. Although every once in a while, I would go out to the Breakwater on like around 67th. Is that 67th? Anyway, it was a big breakwater where they have the bathing thing in you know, right along Lakeshore Drive around maybe at 65th or something. And I would go out and try to outsing the waves.
Oh.
It's, you know, so,
yeah. Yeah.
And so, I kept singing sort of, but for the most part, I forgot about it. And I was really part of the voiceover community. And that really saved me. I made really good money doing that. And I still kept acting a little bit. And then Mary Daly died.
Mm-hmm.
The old, you know, Richard Jay, and all of a sudden movies started to come to town because he kept them out. I lost my first job as an actor in a movie because of him. There was a movie called The Domino Principle,
which
involved Gene Hackman and was about people. It started out with, you know, people escaping from Joliet, which at the time they were on a regular basis. So about one person a month was just walking
kind
out of there.
A documentary.
Right. But Daly didn't trust these Hollywood guys. He didn't want to come in and, you know, messing with his town or, you know, making his town look bad or whatever it is, whatever it was. It's hard for me to know, but they didn't make the movie here, and so I had a relatively small part, so they weren't going to cast me and bring me somewhere else. So I lost my first job because of him, but when he died, all of a sudden people started coming to town. And this was also around the time that Steppenwolf was establishing itself on Broadway. And all of a sudden, if you were a Chicago actor, you were no longer, you know, sort of greeted with the attitude that, hey, listen, if you were any good, you wouldn't be here.
Right.
You know? Now, all of a sudden, if you were in Chicago, you were good because you were natural.
That's right.
Like those Steppenwolf guys.
We're going to take a break and come back, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Chicago reputation in acting and in other areas. We're talking to Bob Swan, a singer, an actor, a voiceover person, an impresario of opera, Acorn Theater. We'll be right back. We're now back with Bob Swan, opera singer, actor, voiceover, voice of beer, and singing against the waves. Now that out singing the waves is quite a venture.
Yeah, especially when they're about 6 foot high. I just go out there and just, you know.
But the problem is. You may win a battle or two.
Yeah.
But they keep coming.
Yeah, I know.
And eventually, you tire out.
I know.
And also, you can't make a living singing against the waves.
No, but, you know, I guess it's the madness that makes you want to do it in the first place or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, because you have to be a little nutty, I think. you've got to be a little nutty to do it. It's a really tough profession.
So Steppenwolf basically changed the way Broadway and legitimate theater nationally
and also Hollywood. They changed. Hollywood is very, very much in tune with all that. And there's John Malkovich all of a sudden became everybody's baby. You know, I can't say I agree completely, but it ultimately helped me, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, we had another phenomenon going on at the same time, and we actually had somebody on our show some time ago who participated in Second City.
Uh-huh.
And so the stand-up improv comedy also, which was Second City was famous for, also took the country by storm, led the country.
Yeah, and they ended up, a lot of those guys ended up going out to Hollywood. You know,
Belushi, John Belushi.
Oh yeah.
Who else? Will Ferrell. Who else? Oh, a number of other folks.
Yeah, there's just so many. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't recall. But it's always been a kind of a major source of talent for Hollywood from around that time.
Mm-hmm. You know. But tell me, how did this work out for you?
Well, you know what? When they came to town. It sort of gave me confidence. These guys are coming to my town, and they wanted a guy from my town. And that's what I was. So it gave me, it kind of empowered me to. I knew that all I had to do was not do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
be normal.
Yeah,
act
just
normal.
Just not do anything. Yeah, there's a story about Peter Ustinov and another great actor were involved in their first movie. And one of them comes up to the other and says, "Well, what are you going to do with your role?" You know, Peter Ustinov said, "Well, I thought I'd do nothing. What are you going to do?" He said, "No, no, no, you can't, dear boy. I'm going to do nothing."
You know, I always got, there's a fellow who actually... I'm not sure if he still comes here, but at one point was spending time here. Dennis Farina.
Yeah, I know Dennis, yeah.
All right,
I played softball with the guy.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was a cop.
He was a cop, and he had a Chicago accent.
Right, and he was an advisor for Michael Mann on the show that he was going to do, and all of a sudden Michael Mann said, "Hey, why don't you be in my show?" And that's it. That was
how it started.
Yeah, but he was actually taking acting classes and doing stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a total fluke. I mean, he's a pretty talented guy. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, he's proved that over the years. I mean, he didn't make one movie and then go off and live.
No.
You know, in the
no,
project.
No, he takes a lick and he keeps on ticking.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, he has family. You know, Ron Farina, who owns the bank in New Buffalo. Mm-hmm. You know, your cousins, I think, or something like that.
But the point I think I want to I'm taking from what you're saying is that Chicago and Chicago theater and Chicago, almost everything, had a renaissance at some point. What time was that? What time period?
Well,
I think
you've got to put it back to the death of Daly. You know, that's what it is for me. And then all of a sudden we started getting like sidewalk cafes.
Mm-hmm.
Which he wasn't in favor of. That was Jane Byrne, I think, did that.
Okay. The king is dead. Let's move ahead.
Yeah, let's move on. And now I think his son has taken it even further to some degree. But, you know, they'd certainly love to have more movies come to town. I know now that the difference in the Canadian dollar and American dollar, now they're coming back, coming back to the States. You know, but
one of the I've heard this commentary made by a number of people. That the movie The Dark Knight, which was filmed in Chicago, really showed off Chicago as a beautiful city of many different contrasts, many different talents, I suppose,
and
views.
They always use some of the same stuff. They always go, you know, underground, the thing.
Wacker Drive.
And, of course, they always use LaSalle Street, and they always wet it down, you know, because it looks more atmospheric, you know, in certain places. But there's a lot more to it, I know. You know, first of all, they have great crews in Chicago. That's another thing, just great crews still here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great look.
Now I'm going to read through some of the movies that you've been in, and you can tell me which was your favorite. Natural Born Killers, Backdraft, Rudy of all places.
Well, Rudy was done by the same guys that did Hoosiers.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was written and directed by the same people who did Hoosiers.
I didn't realize that.
And I was originally supposed to be Rudy's dad, but then they hired this short guy to be Rudy.
Yeah.
And I was like way too tall.
Okay. Betrayed.
Yeah, that was cool. That was a cool.
The
cool
Babe. Thing. The Untouchables. You were a Canadian Mountie.
I got stories about that.
Yeah.
If you want to. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I got the role, I think, because I wore a little maple leaf on my jacket. And you know how directors are like very specific in there, because it was Canadian Mountie, and here's a little Canadian thing, just a little thing like that. And of course, I was a big guy, and I'm kind of pompous. You know, you would never guess that from listening to me now.
But, no.
But you know, so I performed kind of the role of the foolish Mountie who sends his men down too soon. You know,
yeah.
And what happened with this was that I was kind of low on the totem pole out there, along with Andy Garcia. He and I shared the same trailer. And there's a certain kind of like pecking order that happens, with the assistant directors and this and that and the other thing. And if they know you have no power, then they try to mess with you, you know. And I was going to use one of those words that you were saying I shouldn't use.
Okay.
No, but I didn't.
Bless you.
I did not use it. And so the day that I'm supposed to go up, all of a sudden I discovered I was supposed to be on a horse. I'd never been told about that. And the assistant director had told Brian De Palma that I had said that I could ride, but I couldn't ride. So anyway, they call me up late to come up to this mountaintop, whatever, where we're shooting, with all the horses and stuff. And I get up there, and there's Sean Connery, and there's Kevin Costner, and there's Andy Garcia, and everybody. They've been sitting there for a while waiting for me.
Uh-oh.
And so they get me, and we're on the hill. It's about 100 feet down to where the camera is. Uh-huh. The wind's blowing about 40, 50 miles an hour, and there's, in direct, 3 feet in front of the horse is this cliff, And so I start to get up on the horse, and I'm no good at this. I start to fall over the other side, and I get caught. The guy can't, because he could see I didn't know anything about this stuff,
Yeah.
And so I get caught, and I catch a look from Sean Connery, who's going, "Oh, man, this is our Canadian Mountie. He's falling off his horse." But then I'd also decided that the words were all wrong. The words didn't describe what was actually going to be happening in the scene. Plus, I wanted to get a close-up. And Brian De Palma was asking that I actually shout everything. But I didn't want to shout everything. I'd already imagined how I was going to do this. So I'm debating. I'm shouting. I thought I'd have a chance to talk to him about the scene, but I didn't. So I'm shouting down to him about 100 feet down, saying, "No, we got to do it. It's got to be like this, and it's got to be like..." Meanwhile, these guys are sitting over here, like, "Please, could we just do this? Is it possible we could just do this scene?" But I did. I got what I wanted. I got to speak softly for a while, so they had to come in close to and do a close up on me, and I could be my pompous self up close and make an impression. And by the time I got done with all my discussions with De Palma, all the shouting, back and forth, I hear this voice, the Scottish accent, to the right of me saying, "The sun's going down, lad. The sun's going down." Because we were shooting between two mountain ranges, and the sun was going back and forth. We only had between 10 and 4, 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon to shoot this stuff, So I did finally get we finally did this scene, worked out fine and all that. And it was great.
Now, on your horse, did you ride down over the cliff?
I had to, I'll tell you what happened.
Double.
What happened was that then for the scene where I actually get to fire a gun and say charge in a major motion picture. Are you kidding me?
Oh, this is every guy's delight.
That's what I'm saying, So I'm on my horse and they're holding on to him. Out of frame, so that the horse doesn't bolt when I fire. So I fire. We did two takes, and the horse is like going like this each time. And I'm thinking, "Well, thank God they're holding on." They said, "Now we're going to do one when we don't hold on to him." And I said, "Well, I knew the horse didn't like this, and I was having to fire like right by his ear, and they wouldn't put cotton in his ear because that you could see that from because it's huge. It's a big cinema thing, So I fired the gun, and the horse starts walking back up the hill. And I didn't know how to stop a horse going backwards. I started pulling on him, and he starts running back up the hill, literally right into the charging Mountie. And we're slammed on either side. Fortunately, simultaneously, I'm slammed on my thighs on either side by two horses that are going about 30 miles an hour down this this rocky, you know, boulder-infested hill. But I had planned on this.
You did? Oh, yeah.
No. I had figured out if my horse started running down the hill, what would I do? I figured out the angle that I had to be at in order to hang on. And survive. I hung on. I did not fall off. My thighs were bruised for a month after that. And I apparently... in the dailies the next day, they showed the one where my horse started going backwards, and apparently these people went crackers. It was the funniest thing they've ever seen, this stuffy Mountie going boom, and then whoa! You know?
Now, did it stay in the movie?
Oh no!
An outtake once again.
But then they did have some guy. They put a mustache on some guy and let him lead the charge across the bridge because. You know, I think they'd had enough of me and horses.
And the sun had not gone down.
The sun had not gone down, yeah. Now, Sean introduced me to single malt scotch, so I have that to thank
you
for.
So you bonded with Sean. Yeah. This is good. Well, we're going to take a break now. And when we come back, I really want to concentrate on opera, because this is what the people in our area see you as doing most. And so we'll take a break. We're with Bob Swan, impresario of Opera Acorn Theater Three Oaks. We'll be right back. Now back with Bob Swan, opera singer and equestrian extraordinaire, and friend and drinking buddy of Sean Connery.
There you go.
There we go.
There you go.
All right, opera. Let me tell you, I grew up detesting opera. My idea of hell would have been to have been forced to listen to the Texaco opera on Saturday afternoon. Oh,
really?
It was just awful. I mean, I was in the seminary, and
Did you ever see the Firestone Hour? They used to do this stuff, you know, with Richard Tucker and, you know, all these guys.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
I'm telling you, opera was like saying, you like opera, you're a sissy, or this noise is incomprehensible.
Yeah.
All right. I happened to be in Vienna one year, and I mentioned Vienna because I had to go out of the country to do something as radical as going to an opera. So I went to my first opera at the Staatsoper in Vienna, and it was The Abduction from the Seraglio.
Oh, that's funny.
It was hilarious. It was a wonderful.
I've played
wonderful,
it was mean.
Have you?
Yes.
Okay.
You see my resume right there.
And I was entranced. I stood in the front. In the back where they have a number of the cheapest places because you stand the whole time.
Yeah.
And it was the first opera I ever watched. I fell in love with it. It was great. And I realized that what I had been reacting against in opera was the sort of not stereo, but rather very monaural. That is, there's this radio receiver in front of you, and you hear just one sound coming out, and you can't see all the the many actors and many singers singing. When you have, for example, a duo or a trio or a quartet, you don't see them. You don't see how all the harmony and the beauty comes out, mm-hmm. and you don't see the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, I then turned into I can't speak Italian, and I sat and listened to the Three Oaks three tenors,
mm-hmm.
and I recognized enough of the words, but I couldn't put them all together. But one thing I learned is I love to listen to some of the great operas and the great arias mm-hmm. and choruses.
Yeah.
But why is, and this has puzzled me, opera has this reputation for being so stuffy.
Yeah.
And so unavailable to average people.
Yeah, it seems, why? I think it seems to a lot of people like there's this club
mm-hmm.
that they're really not worthy of being in.
Mm-hmm.
And
the people in the club don't want you there because
right.
they love to be very campy. That's
right. And it's a very, it's been and still is really a very small world.
Mm-hmm.
So few people actually know anything at all about opera. I mean, I think one of the reasons, excuse me, our tribute to Pavarotti did so well is that Pavarotti is the only name most people can recognize
mm-hmm.
in opera.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he's dead, so,
he's automatically a saint now.
He was far from a saint,
right.
I understand, you know. But
you didn't drink with him, did you?
No, I've never met him.
Oh, okay.
And apparently,
right.
just as well, because apparently he really smelled. That's all I can say. He was really, really a peasant, you know. What we try to do at Three Oaks, the Acorn, is cut through all that crap. I can mm-hmm. say crap.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
okay,
a provable word. Yeah.
Yeah. We are casual chic, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about great music and great singing.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. And number two is making sure people understand it and mm-hmm. can relate to it. And so what you saw Saturday night with the three other tenors was kind of like maybe the best example of the kind of stuff that we do, the approachability
mm-hmm.
and the ability of the, mm-hmm. of the singers sort of combined. Because if you're joking around, you got to be able to sing the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys can all sing the stuff in mm-hmm. in a way that for most people is you can't tell a difference between them and, you know, Plácido or maybe Pavarotti even, mm-hmm. you know, if I may say, because, you know, the Franco Martorano, when he sang Lucia van le Stelle, he sang it really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And Simon Lee sang Nessun Dorma.
Oh.
And he sang the crap out of it.
Yeah,
I can use,
absolutely.
That's the word
I'd,
I can use.
I'd like to use one of the completely forbidden words.
Yeah, I know.
It
yeah.
was a one. All right, I think that is one of the most beautiful pieces in all of opera
that I've heard. Yeah.
Nessun Dorma. And I think it's sad, but I remember in the Sum of All Fears, the movie with Jack Clancy. It's one of those Clancy movies.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And the only problem was they sang Nessun Dorma as people were being blown up and shot, which I thought was but it was dramatic, let me tell you.
Well, don't forget that at the end of Dr. Strangelove, it's, we'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when. One of my very favorite movies, I got to say, you know, and very frightening these days, since we have General Jack Ripper as president, or as vice president, you know, whatever. So.
Well, your experience in bringing to us opera and translating it, mm-hmm. if you will, not the language, the language too, mm-hmm. but translating it to something which is appealable to common people. I mean, I consider myself as common as
I can imagine. What I try to do is make it appeal not only to what you call common people, as regular folks who may or may not have heard very much, but I'm also trying to appeal to people who really, really know a lot about opera and really like singing.
Mm-hmm.
We had some people from WFMT come see our La Traviata. And they compared our soprano Christine Steyer to Lucia Albanese in a positive way. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about some people who know more about opera than you or I could ever dream of. You know, and they loved it for the singing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we make it accessible. That La Traviata had a narration along with it, so that you knew exactly what they were singing about.
Mm-hmm.
I just did the Magic Flute, where I cut out all the fat.
Mm-hmm.
I cut out the choruses. I cut out all these little parts. I've done Magic Flute many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really gotten into much of the stuff that is in the middle of it. That, mm-hmm. you know, it has a whole bunch, however, of great arias.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very whimsical. So when I took out all the what I considered to be extra stuff, all of a sudden we went from a four-hour opera to a one-hour, 45-minute opera. Mm-hmm. I did super titles like they do at the Lyric Opera,
mm-hmm.
so we didn't need much of a narration. I just sort of narrated a little bit to sort of, you know, mm-hmm. hold things together, mm-hmm. just a little bit. And I did all the bass parts, and I got a bunch of wonderful singers, and they, again, sang the crap out of it, and people loved it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very easy, light, accessible opera, which gets... I mean, often enough, when it gets done, you know, echt, as they say, auf Deutsch, if they, the purist, when they get hold of it, there's all this dialogue mm-hmm. that is really unentertaining. I mean, it's boring, boring, boring stuff.
We used to say that Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, and I have not opera in my background, but philosophy, we used to say that Kant believed in the proverb, why say it in one word if you can say it in 10?
Yeah, right.
So what you're basically saying is that when you get into Wagner, you have a lot of extra.
Oh, I'm telling you, what I would kind of like to do, I'd like to try doing Wagner at the Acorn. I mean, just because, first of all, it amuses me, the mm-hmm. thought of doing it. But, you know, for example, in the Meistersinger von Nuremberg, the guy sings the prize song 5 times. And it's not the best song in the show. It's just not. It's actually not that good a song. And he sings it 5 times. And when he starts for the 4th time, you're thinking, no.
No, please. Stop please it. Stop. Stop. Is this it. Torture? Am I being waterboarded?
Yeah. You know.
I'll tell you, the regimen is on. It's on its way.
Reminds me of the story about some woman. There's a very long aria that King Mark sings in the 3rd act of Tristan. And it goes on for, you know, it's very morose, and it's sort of, Mir dies Tristan, mir Bogin und Treue da Tree. And it goes
please,
on like,
no more, no
and
more.
It goes on for about 10 minutes like that. And this, I think this was at Covent Garden. And all of a sudden, you know, a woman's voice sort of poked through one of the pauses in the song and said, oh, dear boy, that's quite enough. And we don't want people talking like that at the Acorn. We supercharge our shows and make sure that it's packed with great songs.
So the other night at the Acorn, there were two women in the front row who kept intervening and telling your tenors, that was very good. Oh, but I saw.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, it was great. And one woman's about, I will be kind, in her 70s, maybe 80s, maybe 90s.
Yeah.
And she was articulate and was right on top of her experiences with different operas, different singers. And then the woman, younger woman who was with her, pretty much the same. But your tenor, who is leading the dialogue, Warren was played right into it and made her a part of the program. And it made it very much an interchange of experiences and emotions. And I think the whole audience actually appreciated, got a charge out of it.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. I can't stand this because I really enjoy talking to you. We have not talked.
I have all kinds of other lies to tell.
Well, you know, with the fact that I've strapped you up with little wires and antenna all over you and running this
and
chart.
Tried me with alcohol.
And can show you that, you know, where you're lying. I'm going to play that for the audience next week.
Okay.
These are the lies of Bob Swan.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, I'd like to have you come back. I'd like to talk more about opera, more about your life, but about what can we bring about? What does the Acorn Theater offer you as a venue to offer things to other people, and to how can we transform the area of Three Oaks and of the Acorn Theater into something which is even more of a magnet for good art, good music in the future. Now, that's for another show.
Yeah, because I got a really long answer for that, so okay. You know, I would not want to do that.
Well, but, unfortunately, I have a minute and 2 seconds.
Oh, really?
But you can give it.
Well, the pressure's on.
I know. Can you come back again?
Sure, yeah.
This was a lot of fun, yeah. And I hope that everybody in the audience enjoyed talking and listening to you as much as I have. The name of our program is With Respect. Our guest today has been Bob Swan, Basso Profundo, okay, and star, and impresario, and actor, and horseback rider, and buddy to the stars.
Oh, yeah.
Please join us again. Our program, With Respect, is on every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock and every Thursday morning at 10 o'clock. We'll be talking to you and with you next week. With Respect.